Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday. We get to hear, lucky us, the trustworthy and beautifully timbered voice of Steve Inskeep this hour. I just wanted to say I really like his voice. I like what he has to say, too. But he's got this perfect radio voice because you can hear it. It just carries into the living room. And it's clear and it's understandable. And so I was looking for the right phrase. Beautifully timbered? Is that okay? He's going to be talking about his very interesting new book, Jackson Land, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and a Great American Land Grab. As he describes it, the story follows two men who fought for more than 20 years. They fought over land in the American South, which is where they lived, though some said it wasn't big enough for the two of them because of who they were. One, Andrew Jackson, became a general, then president. The other, John Ross, who was Native American, but I believe only one-eighth Native American, became principal chief of the Cherokee Nation and became Jackson's, as Steve says, cleverest opponent. Steve is co-host of the morning edition on NPR. He was hired in 96. He covered so much: presidential primary in New Hampshire, the Pentagon, the Senate, the 2000 non-ending presidential campaign, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, the conflict in Nigeria. He traveled across North Africa in the wake of the Arab Spring. He reported from Syria. He drove 2,428 miles along the entire U.S.-Mexico border for a series, and we're just delighted to have him with us. And we'll be welcoming phone calls. Every now and then, Andrew Jackson's name pops into conversation here, so I'm sure some of you will have maybe read the book or you'll want to talk about the two we'll be talking about. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Steve.
Hi, what a wonderful introduction. Thank you. I'm going to write down beautifully timbered because it makes me sound like a wood frame house. I really appreciate that.
Oh, and that's
that house is beautifully timbered. Thank you very much. Thank you.
It is. It's a voice. And I don't really look at how people look or how they sound particularly, but there is something really clear about your voice, which is, I love it. So
thank you.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Can I just go away now and blush somewhere?
Well, no, because I don't know what I do. I can't carry an hour on Jackson.
Where do you go on? Where do you go on from this? Yeah, exactly.
let's
listen to your beautifully timbered voice. Throw a question at me. Anything you want.
All right, I'll do that. Why didn't we know very much about John Ross? I mean, this guy is absolutely fascinating. We know a whole lot about Andrew, but we don't know very much about Ross. And you didn't know much about him until the book, right?
Oh, I didn't even know his name until I got researching on this topic. There's a lot of reasons, and some of them seem kind of obvious. History gets written by the winners, and Andrew Jackson was a winner. He was also just plain the president. But there's something else going on here that I think is significant. People know something about the Trail of Tears, the Cherokee removal story. There are national historic places. People learned it in elementary school anymore. So people know something about the story, or at least the very end of the very long story that I try to tell.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel that sometimes in that kind of telling, the telling of the eviction of Native Americans from the eastern United States, the Indians are faceless victims in a drama that's really about the arguments and disagreements of white people. And I'm not sure that in at least popular literature, and I don't mean scholarship, there's been great scholarship, but in popular literature, I'm not sure that the specific role of Indians in defending themselves has been highlighted all that much. And so John Ross, who was central to the Indians taking agency and defending themselves, is not nearly as well known as he could be, except around Chattanooga, where he was from, modern-day Chattanooga, which used to be called Ross's Landing, by the way.
Interesting. And what's interesting is that here's a man who I believe, Steve, was only one-eighth Cherokee, right? And yet he became principal chief of the Cherokee Nation. There must have been a point, and there was a point, where he could pass as white, probably, for most of his life, but he identified, obviously, strongly with being a Cherokee.
Yeah, it's an amazing fact and an amazing realization. that he could become leader of the Cherokee Nation, even though he was 1/8 Cherokee. And part of the reason that would be is that I don't think Cherokees of that era would have looked at it precisely that way. It was white people who were focused on racial purity, and Cherokees just had a different way of looking at things. Ross was the son and grandson of Scottish traders who had come to live among the Cherokees of the Southern Appalachians and married Cherokee women. And so his mother was Cherokee, his grandmother was Cherokee, his great-grandmother was a full-blooded Cherokee. And the Cherokees were a matrilineal society. They traced ancestry through the mother's side. And so to any Cherokee looking at him, well, his mom was a Cherokee, so he was a Cherokee. And it was a culture that was used to intermarriage between clans, which the tribe was divided into clans, between different tribes, and also just intermarriage with white people. It was rather common. And so it wasn't anything that was all that big a deal in the Cherokee Nation, although white people at that time did sometimes make a big deal of it. And when they were opposed to John Ross, they sometimes suggested he wasn't a real Indian, even though Indians had chosen him as their leader.
Interesting. Tell us about the moment where he had to pass as white. It was a moment where he could have been killed. And And the Spanish speakers on the boat, they had to speak Spanish, and one of the people had to leave the boat.
Oh, yeah. I think this probably is one of many occasions when he did pass as white or leaned a little more on his white ancestry than his Indian ancestry, depending on circumstances. He's a young man. He's around 22 years old. It's December of 1812, and he got on a boat with three other men and was going down the Tennessee River. He was on his way downriver and across the Mississippi, in fact, to do some trading with Cherokees who at that time lived west of the Mississippi. And he was hailed, as he recorded in a letter, by a party of white men on shore who wanted them to stop. Ross was afraid of the men and did not want to stop. They threatened to get a party and kill him because these were armed men who had been told not to let any Indian boats, as they called it, pass that place on the Tennessee River. It's during the War of 1812. Everybody's very tense. And Ross did this amazing thing. He could pass as white because he was partly white and could speak clear English. There was another man of mixed race who could speak English, so that guy could pass as white. There was a third man described as a servant, probably a slave, and he was a black man. He would be ignored. Then there was a full-blooded Indian who couldn't fool anybody into thinking that he was not an Indian. They put the Indian off the boat. They put the full-blooded Indian off the boat so that the remaining men could pass as non-Indian should this party ever catch up to them downriver and threaten them in some way. It did seem to be a moment when everybody's life was at stake, and they put the guy who could not pass off the boat, and he walked for 30 miles overland and met them later downstream when the danger had passed. I begin the book with that story because I think it illustrates the perilous and intricate world in which John Ross lived, and also the racial complexity of this time. Mm-hmm. We think of this as a modern thing, the incredible diversity of America, but of course America's always been diverse and people have always had complicated identities here.
And we've always had problems with race, it would appear.
Oh, absolutely. And attitudes were very different then. But that, too, was complicated. You think about the problems that people had later on with racial intermarriage, and it was actually outlawed in many states for a long period of time. But you discover that in certain circumstances, it was accepted. And there were all these unwritten rules which you encounter when you study this period. One of them being that if white men went into the Cherokee country or the country of other Indian nations and married Indian women, no one particularly cared. The Indians generally did not care. White people did not raise a stink about it. Intermarriage was not a problem. By the 1830s, something like a quarter of the Cherokee Nation had some sliver or more of white blood, as white people would have put it. But if you go the other way, there are instances in this book in which Cherokee men went into, say, Connecticut and married white women. And then there was an eruption of hostility and people were burned in effigy and there was a great deal of anxiety about this. So if it was happening off in the mountains among the Indians, it was okay. If it was happening in a white community, that was very strange and troubling to people.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the complexity of Ross's story, and we've just heard an inkling of that. It's kind of a complex story with Andrew Jackson, too. I'm always amazed by people, Steve, who are like he's not like Abraham Lincoln. He's far from him. But the guy's an orphan. He doesn't know his dad. His mom dies when he's very young, and yet he becomes president of the United States. Those stories just dumbfound me.
Yes, they do. And I appreciate you bringing up complexity, because I think we have to regard, well, everybody in history, and especially Andrew Jackson, for their complexity. This is a guy who, for a long time in our history, was an absolute and unvarnished hero, and even his flaws were considered great. Mm-hmm. And he was huge, which is why he ended up on the $20 bill. In more recent years, the tide has turned, and there are people who call him a monster, accuse him of genocide, make all kinds of amazing accusations. And frankly, there's room for some truth in both of those versions of Andrew Jackson, but on the whole, neither one is accurate. Neither one is even fair. And I think we have to regard him and his complexity as a guy who did start from humble beginnings, who did rise to be president, who added a lot to American democracy, who had unbelievable tenacity and persistence and strategic sense, but tragically turned those talents to some outrageous goals. And it's now widely accepted. You can hardly find anybody who would say the Trail of Tears was a great thing or well done. And this was the end result of a policy that Jackson led as president, and it wasn't even the only terrible result. Thousands of people died as a result of forced removals or of wars that resulted from his policy of trying to clear Indians off the real estate of what is now the Deep South, much of the southern United States.
Mm-hmm. You say toward the end of the book that you feel in a way that you were completing some of the volumes that Teddy Roosevelt had set out to write and just didn't have a chance to finish. I thought that was interesting.
Well, first, it's always flattering when you refer to something way late in a book like that when you're the author. Thank you very much for bringing that
up.
You're
welcome.
Yeah. Theodore Roosevelt. When I was a kid, I was a big fan of Theodore Roosevelt, and so I'd always known that he was an author as well as a politician. And there was a period before he became a war hero and governor of New York and president that he was a historian. And he wrote a four-volume history called The Winning of the West, which I've now read a lot of, and it's really fascinating writing. And he's looking at the colonial period and a little beyond the colonial period as Americans, the colonists, began moving west over the Appalachians, often fighting with Indians along the way, and settled what was to them new country. And it is a fascinating story. It is a story that Roosevelt tells in ways that we would consider wildly inappropriate today, as racial attitudes would be considered way out of date. But one thing you have to give him credit for is that Roosevelt wanted to tell the truth about the brutality and the difficulty of this conflict between white settlers and Indians. And he did include a lot of brutal detail in the battles and the efforts and the settlement of that period. And so it's, in its own way, with the exceptions that I mentioned, a really impressive history. Mm-hmm. He intended to do two more volumes. There were four volumes. He intended to do two more. Had he had time to do them, he would have covered the events in Jacksonland. He didn't have time. He was busy being president or something. But in any case, the story is still there, and I try to pick it up a little bit.
Mm. Well, let's see. We tend to think of Andrew Jackson, many people do now, modern historians, as an Indian hater. And you say at some point that it was deeper than that, that he believed, perhaps, did he believe that the Cherokees might be better off and other Native Americans better off, and their very survival depended on their going elsewhere? And I also want you to tell the story because it indicates that he couldn't have been a complete hater because he adopted this Indian child.
Well, yeah, Indian hater does seem too simple to me. I don't know that the more complicated explanation makes him look that much better, but it makes him look different.
Mm-hmm.
You are exactly correct that Andrew Jackson could, in certain instances, be fair to Indians. Cherokees served in his army in the War of 1812. He promised them at that early date pay and benefits equal to white soldiers. And when he found out after the war that some Cherokee widows were not getting the death benefits they should have received, he went to bat for them and wrote a letter to Washington and said, "I've made this promise believing it was just." So this is a guy who could be fair under certain circumstances. You're correct also that he adopted an Indian child, but we have to put a big asterisk over that, and it begins to get at the complexity of this guy. He had Indians in his army in the War of 1812. They were attacking other Indians, Creek Red Stick rebels, and it was a brutal, no-holds-barred war, and the troops under Jackson's command were attacking villages and killing large numbers of people, and after an attack on one village, there was a baby whose parents had both been killed. And Jackson sent the baby home with a note to his wife, Rachel, saying, "I send along a little Indian boy for Andrew, their adopted white son. So there's some ambiguity. Did he mean to take this child as a child? Did he mean to send this child as a playmate, as a toy almost? There's some debate about that. Mm. But he was clearly sympathetic to this orphan of war as he had been an orphan of war. The problem with Jackson is not that he was totally unfair to Indians. We've just given examples where he could show some sympathy and even accord some fairness. It's that when anybody got in the way of what he wanted, he would stop at nothing. And the Indians were in the way of him clearing the South for white settlement and also participating in the real estate market that would result. And it's in that circumstance that he would see Indian life only one way. And the way that he came to see it was in perfect accord with his real estate interests, that it would be really much better for them if they got away from white civilization, which was causing them trouble, and went across the river. It's an argument that the Mississippi River, it's an argument that many supporters of Indians made, that even some Indians made. But Jackson acted out of complex motives at best, certainly not entirely pure motives.
And did he ever take the land? Didn't he? Huge amounts.
Yeah. This is something I had no idea about, and I think that I report in greater detail than has been reported previously. I made a calculation based on federal land records, which are really quite strikingly accessible in the modern age. Federal land records, after about the year 1818, Jackson had arranged as a general, a public servant, to obtain much of the Tennessee River Valley in North Alabama for the United States. The land then went up for sale, and Jackson, while still a public official, arranged to buy large amounts of the land along with a bunch of his friends and relatives. In total, I was able to associate their names with some 45,000 acres of land. Much of it was used as cotton plantations at a time when cotton prices were at record highs. Even the most conservative calculations appear to suggest that Jackson made tens of thousands of dollars in a short period, which was a lot of money then. And his friends founded a city, Florence, Alabama, that Jackson participated in. And the city is still there. It's a wonderful city. It's an amazing legacy, the Tennessee River Valley. Jackson made it, which is why there is a Jackson County, Alabama, in the Tennessee River Valley, and Jackson's name is all over everything else. But he was making money at the same time that, in his view, he was serving the public.
All right. Is that the city that gave you the bobblehead?
No, I received a bobblehead just yesterday, an Andrew Jackson bobblehead. It was a gift from the folks at the Hermitage, which is Jackson's house in Nashville, Tennessee. I had an opportunity to speak in Nashville and meet with some people from the Hermitage. It has been so fascinating to put this book out there and to talk about it in Nashville, Jackson's hometown, and also to talk about it in Cherokee, North Carolina, where there still are Cherokees today whose ancestors managed to avoid being removed. It is a difficult and painful story for all people involved, but you've got to give everybody credit. They have embraced the complexity of the story as well as they can, and asked hard and painful questions sometimes. But it's been fantastic to just try to get this story out there and be as truthful as I can to all sides.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Steve. Steve Inskeep is our guest. You can tell from his voice, I'm sure, by this point. He is the author of Jacksonland, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and A Great American Land Grab. Here's our phone number. I hope some of you have had it. The book is very recently released. But maybe some of you have had a chance to read it. You obviously know the story of President Andrew Jackson, perhaps not as much this early part of his life, but maybe not as much the story of John Ross, which is equally as compelling in this book. Steve writes at the end of the book, Martin Van Buren was right. He predicted that while other controversies that agitated the public mind in their day would fade, the emotions aroused by Indian removal would probably endure as long as the government itself. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. We're on Facebook as well, the Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter. And that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stephen Skeep is with us this hour, author of Jackson Land, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and A Great American Land Grab. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we start our calls with Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Okay, this is really interesting, and I wanted to ask Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
A long time ago, I read this novel about an Indian leader named Osceola, who was a Seminole in Florida. And as I recall, Osceola tried to unite a lot of the southern tribes to fight the U.S. Army during the same time period, and just, like, you know, failed and died. But and so my question is, were they contemporaries, and did Osceola try to unite these tribes, and was John Ross and him, did they ever meet? Did they know each other?
Yeah, maybe? Yeah. I can tell you a little bit of that story. Osceola was, I believe, a younger man, but lived in the same period. His family was among the Creeks of Alabama. They were driven out of the state effectively by Andrew Jackson's army in the War of 1812. They ended up living in Florida, which was then Spanish Florida, then became property of the United States, thanks to an invasion in part by Andrew Jackson. Osceola was a young man in the 1830s when Andrew Jackson was president and was pushing the Seminoles to leave Florida. And the Seminoles were a loosely knit group of a number of different tribes or small clans. And some of them were from Alabama, like his family was, and some of them had been in Florida longer. And their chiefs signed a treaty. It was necessary to get treaties for people to move west. Their chiefs signed a treaty agreeing to move west to what is now Oklahoma, but there was much dissent about this. The leaders were illiterate. They put their X marks on this treaty, and some of them later denied signing it at all. Osceola was a younger man who had not signed the treaty and rose up in revolt. He ended up leading a revolt that became the Second Seminole War. It lasted. This is an incredible story. I'd hardly heard anything of this. But Osceola and other Seminole leaders battled the United States Army. The fight went on for something like 7 years, so it's as long as the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. More than 1,500 U.S. troops were killed, along with I don't know how many Indians. And so the death toll, at least among U.S. troops, in terms of a percentage of the national population at the time, worse than Iraq, worse than the Iraq War. Unbelievable conflict. Osceola, you're also correct, didn't last all that long because he was betrayed by the United States. He was offered in for peace negotiations, and while he was standing there getting ready to negotiate, they just took him prisoner and clapped him off to a prison in Charleston, South Carolina, where he died. I think of malaria. He died in prison in any case. John Ross was a contemporary, and he was also used by the United States government. They were trying to get the Cherokees to move from Georgia, but at the same time they were pressuring John Ross. They asked for his help. They said, we're having trouble with these Seminoles in Florida, and you're a guy who's a man of peace. Surely you can help them give up this war that they're fighting. And Ross wrote a letter, sent it to Florida with four Cherokees to deliver it, and they summoned some Seminole leaders in to read the letter, and as soon as they were brought in to have the letter read to them, the U.S. Army captured them too. And took them. I mean, this was considered really dishonorable at the time, and this is one of the reasons, as I understand it, that Osceola, even though he had attacked the United States, murdered a federal agent, done all kinds of terrible things, became a hero, not just among Indians, but among white people. And you have an Osceola, Florida now. You have an Osceola County, Michigan, which I believe was named in the 1840s. You have other Osceola counties across the country. This guy was a national hero of sorts, and it's not surprising that with the approval of Seminoles, he is the mascot of a university in Florida now.
Oh,
I mean, it's an incredible, right, incredible backstory that gets to the brutality and the double dealing of this period.
Thanks so much for your call, Sarah. We'll take more in a moment. Let's talk a little bit about where John Ross wanted the Cherokees to go. I find this story fascinating that you write that some Cherokees wanted to hold on to a cultural past, but the majority stood behind Ross, who really wanted the Cherokees to be a part of the U.S. and crafted, Ross, that is, a constitution.
Yeah, this is one of many things that the Cherokees did to try to assimilate to the country that was surrounding them, the white settlement that was surrounding them. They changed their clothing. They wore white man's clothes. They changed their economy. They changed their agriculture. They changed their architecture. And you're right, they changed their government. In 1827, I didn't know this a few years ago, in 1827, the Cherokees passed a new constitution modeled loosely on the United States Constitution. It actually begins with a preamble very much like the preamble of the U.S. Constitution, we the people, and so forth. And they were trying to make themselves in this area of land that we see on a map as North Georgia and part of Tennessee and some other states. They were trying to make themselves a territory or a state within the Union. Now, this ambition didn't get very far. I don't see any detailed descriptions of it, but there are references to Ross himself having an ambition to make the Cherokee Nation a territory or state of the Union, which is an incredible alternative history to consider. The history of the South, the history of the United States would have been very different, but it was never seriously considered at the time. There was no path there in a country with the racial attitudes that the United States had at that time.
Were there any well-known people we would remember today, politicians who championed his cause?
Oh, absolutely. This, to me, is one of the most important parts of the story. Andrew Jackson is a hero of the early American democracy because of some of the reasons that we said. John Ross, in his own way, was a hero of democracy, too, or certainly added to our democratic tradition, because the Cherokees started a newspaper and used it to spread the word of their views to the white communities of America. They knew in a democracy that they needed allies. They were outnumbered, couldn't vote in federal elections anyway, and so they got white allies. There were missionaries in the Cherokee Nation who had come to the Cherokee Nation to spread the word of God to heathens, as Indians and other non-Christians were often called in that era. And the Cherokees took this advice, and many of them converted to Christianity, but they also flipped the missionaries and used the missionaries to get the word of Cherokees back to the white community. And that activated this network of preachers and politicians and publishers who were Christian at a time of, it's called the Second Great Awakening, a time of great religious revival and reform. And those folks fought on the Cherokees' side against President Jackson, along with other allies that they gained along the way. And there was a very close vote on this issue in the House of Representatives. It was decided by only a handful of votes.
And we'll talk about people like John Quincy Adams and Henry Clay as we carry along here. Scott is our next caller in La Crosse. Hey, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. This sounds like a fascinating book.
And you'll like it, Scott.
I'm grateful to you, Mr. Inskeep, for writing it. My understanding anyway, is that it's kind of traditional for a lot of Native Americans to not carry $20 bills in their wallet. And I was wondering if you ran across that and how far back that tradition goes. And wouldn't it be ironic with this move on now to try and get a woman on the $20 bill if Andrew Jackson went away and somebody like Sacagawea went on?
Yeah, no, it'd be fascinating. Yeah. It'd be fascinating. The dislike of the $20 bill is real. I don't want to represent that as being something that everybody who's Indian feels the same way, but you certainly run across people for whom it is real, who tell stories of their grandmother who refused to carry $20 bills, or a Cherokee woman who I met just the other day who was telling me that when she was a kid, her father taught her to draw by defacing $20 bills.
Really?
Know, all over Andrew Jackson's face.
Huh.
Now, I wrote in the New York Times the other day a proposal to do something with the $20 bill, and of course I'm not the only person to propose this. People have proposed an Indian leader on the $20 bill. They've proposed a black man on the $20 bill. There's the Women on 20s movement, which had a sort of online election. How democratic in this era of democracy. an online election and voted for Harriet Tubman, which is great. Although I had a different proposal, which is to put John Ross in the $20 bill.
Yeah, there you go.
And flip it over and put Andrew Jackson on the other side, which is not to say that either man is perfect, but to say that together they tell a story. It's a story of our democracy, how it changed and grew, and about how democracy works and sometimes fails. Imperfect people collide and debate in this system, and they reach a decision, and it's a good one or a bad one, but the argument goes on, and you hope that the decisions get better over time. And I think we could run right through the currency like that and end up with two people on every bill, and they'd be a very diverse group of people, many different races, men and women, and people, two people at a time from the same era who contended against one another or at least had different points of view on the same subject.
Mm. Anything else, Mr. Scott?
Well, actually, yeah, one more quick comment I'd like to make, which is that I read your colleague David Green's book, Midnight in Siberia.
Oh, yeah, good book.
I just enjoyed the heck out of that. And if your book is anything that well written, and I have a hunch it might be, I'm looking forward to this, too, as well. Thank you so much for writing it.
Thank you very much. You can decide that if you get a look at it. And come back to me and you can judge. I won't judge that, but I'll agree with you about David's book. It was a good one.
Yeah, and I can say that your book is a good one, too, because I read
sweet.
Most
Thank
of it.
You.
It's good. Thanks, Scott, always for your call. Tom in Whitewater. Hi.
Hi. I just listening today, and I was quite excited to hear about John Ross. My great-great-grandfather was a fellow by the name of Addison Proctor. I don't know if that name rings a bell. But he worked for the department that helped move the Cherokees at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually gave a speech to the Chicago Historical Society in 1920. And he says of John Ross in that speech, he said, "Now the Cherokees were particularly fortunate in this, that they had for a chief John Ross. Huh. I suppose John Ross, if he were living today and lived in Oklahoma, would probably be the United States Senator from there." He was a man of splendid ability, a real statesman, a man of vision, a wonderful man. He was a half-breed. Of course, this is dated conversation. His father was full-blooded Scotch and his mother a full-blooded Cherokee Indian. And so he had all the qualities of a Scotsman and all the intrigues of an Indian.
Fascinating. I should, I guess, mention he must have been quite an old man in 1920 since the removal happened in 1838.
Yeah.
What a fascinating speech to have given. This is an ancestor of yours, you said.
Yeah, John Proctor. He was the youngest delegate to the convention that elected Lincoln, and at 1920 he was still the last living delegate from that convention, and that's why the Chicago Historical Society was having him give some speeches.
Hmm.
Wow, what an amazing story.
Yeah, that's why you love talk shows. You never know what story is next, right? Call is next. Thank you so much for your call, Tom. Our number is 800-486-8655. Tell us, if you would please, Steve, the story of the 1832 Supreme Court ruling and John Ross's work with the Supreme Court on Indian removal.
Well, we talked about the way that Ross fought within the Democratic system. They fought in the press. They gained white allies. They fought in Congress. And when everything else failed, they went before the United States Supreme Court. It's a pattern that, to me, resembles what African-American leaders did in a later century to achieve civil rights. African-Americans, of course, ended up before the Supreme Court with rulings like Brown versus Board of Education. In 1832, there was a case called Worcester versus Georgia. It was, in effect, it's a little more complicated, but in effect, the Cherokees challenging the state of Georgia, which wanted to impose its law on the Cherokee Nation in North Georgia, and the Cherokees resisting and saying, we don't have to do what a state tells us to do. We're under the federal government, but we don't have to deal with the states. John Marshall, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, encouraged the case. There's a whole backstory which is astonishing and would probably be seen as unethical in a modern day court or many modern day courts. He actually was openly sympathetic to the Cherokee case, reached out to lawmakers sympathetic to the Cherokees, said, hey, why don't you send a case my way? I think I could do something with that. Mm-hmm. The Cherokees sent a case his way. He ruled against them. He didn't like their law. Their argument on the law. But then a second case was brought by the Cherokees, and this time Marshall ruled in their favor. It's an extremely clear ruling. You don't have to buy the book to read about it, although I'm happy if you do, but you can find the whole thing online. It's a great case to read, and it just very clearly says some very simple facts, which to Marshall boiled down to the Indians were here before white settlement. They have the right to their land. It's a legal right, and nothing has happened that has taken away their sovereignty over that land that they still possess, that they haven't previously lost through wars and treaties and purchases and so forth. And so under Marshall's view of history, the United States had the right to be where it was, but the Cherokees had the right to be where they were, and the U.S. didn't have the right to grab their land, and the states certainly didn't have the right to impose their laws on Cherokee land. Very clear ruling, in the end, had no effect. The Georgians refused to acknowledge the existence of the ruling at all, or at least the jurisdiction of the court, didn't even send a lawyer to argue it. President Jackson, Andrew Jackson was president by that time, made it clear publicly he disapproved of this ruling, and while he did not ignore it entirely, he, over time, engaged in some political machinations to make sure that the case was dismissed, that it was withdrawn, and the legal effect, the full effect of Marshall's ruling was never felt. It is, to me, an incredible story. And you think about how history would be different if that's how President Eisenhower treated Brown versus Board of Education in the 1950s.
Yes, absolutely. Let's go to Bonnie in Blue Mounds. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm listening and I'm thinking of the reading that I've been doing about the Cherokee people. And in a way, this Andrew Jackson and John Ross both having their good and bad aspects, I suppose it was true. It just doesn't sound very right for me. And that it seemed like what was happening was such a racist-driven, it was basically, it seems like, genocide, which eventually happened all across the United States, you know, as the white people pushed westward. And the Cherokee people were very literate, and, you know, as you were saying, they had their own newspaper, you know, they were... So it just seems to me like it was a matter of racism that was the U.S. government and military had the power and they were able to do what they did. And
What about the element
Thanks.
Of racism?
Oh, totally. Well, I'm going to agree with the vast majority of what Bonnie said. I'm going to respectfully disagree with a couple of the word choices. By saying that both of my main characters are imperfect, I don't mean to say that they're the same or that no one is at fault. I think history has rendered its judgment on the Trail of Tears and mm-hmm. who was right and who was wrong. I simply mean to point out that John Ross was himself a slave owner, for example, that he was a politician, that he cut deals, that he had mixed motives, that he was a human being. And on Andrew Jackson's side, I don't think there's any doubt that history has judged him wrong on the Trail of Tears, or really on the policies that led to the Trail of Tears, since he was out of office by the time the actual movement happened. But let's look at this carefully here. I would argue with the word choice genocide. I recognize that some people use it. I understand why they use it, because they are thinking of the broad sweep of history of European contact with Native Americans, and so very many people died of disease or of war. And so I understand that. But in the specific instance we're talking about here, it doesn't seem appropriate, because we're talking about Jackson as a representative of the United States government at that time, and the policy, the intent, was not to exterminate a people, which to me is the basic definition of genocide, or at least to kill large numbers of people. The intent, supposedly, was to save them. Andrew Jackson would make this argument that it would be better for the Cherokees and other Indians if they were removed from white civilization. And to be fair to Jackson, sounds pretty awful when you say that, to be fair to Jackson, there were sincere supporters of the Cherokees and even some Cherokees and other Indians who agreed with this and argued that white civilization was destroying Indians because of alcohol sellers, land grabbers, and other corrupting influences, and it would be better to get away and get across the Mississippi and pursue an independent existence. So Andrew Jackson made this argument. But the two things that you do have to say are, first, what he was talking about was a brutal segregation of the continent. Mm-hmm. One race can be over here with its black slaves, and the other race can be over there across the river. Segregation, I think, is a harsh enough word and entirely appropriate, entirely fair for what the policy was. The other thing we have to say is that whatever Andrew Jackson thought was good for the Cherokees, the overwhelming majority of Cherokees didn't think so. didn't agree. And there's a record where there were mass meetings with thousands of people, and they voted, 95% or more in favor of their leader, John Ross, who wanted them to stay and believed that he was following their interests in stubbornly resisting and trying to get them to stay. And Jackson and his successor, Martin Van Buren, and the governments of the time overrode the wishes of the Cherokee people, overrode the ruling and judgment of the law as interpreted by the United States Supreme Court, and did what they wanted to do because they were interested in white settlement and interested in real estate.
Mm. You know, it's interesting, as you were saying all that, I was thinking about the same kinds of ideas that were being spouted during the whole Let's Send African Americans Back to Africa movement.
Oh, yeah, and this is happening at the same period. Almost concurrent, there was this movement which was seen as liberal and enlightened and thoughtful, that slavery was tragic, but, you know, slave owners, they've got property rights, and so you can't just free everybody. And people were racist. A lot of people were racist and didn't want black free people among them. And so how much better and better for them, better for the slaves, if they were freed gradually and sent back to Africa? The Indian removal was the same kind of idea. And fascinatingly, the people who opposed Indian removal, many of them lost that battle but went on to another battle. They changed their views about sending former slaves back to Africa, and many of them moved on to a very different solution, abolishing slavery. This is sort of what I mean about democratic debate and how hopefully our decisions get better over time. This was a tragedy in American democracy, and yet it changed people's thinking and had a serious influence, a measurable influence on later issues, including the debate over slavery. This is a prequel. This is part of the events that led up to the Civil War.
Sometimes it takes a long time, though, doesn't it, Steve?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's why we're here. We keep, you know, we do, you and I both, we do a show today. We'll do another show tomorrow. We'll keep working at it, keep listening, and keep learning.
I know, how true.
Steve Inskeep is our guest. We'll take more phone calls momentarily. His book is Jacksonland, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and a Great American Land Grab. We have yet to talk about the War of 1812, when Ross and Jackson kind of worked together to get rid of the Brits. So let's talk about that with Steve. And I want to take many more of your phone calls, probably most importantly. So we'll be with you and with him and continue in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls for Steve Inskeep. Jim in Oconomowoc, hi.
Hi, Mr. Inskeep. It's nice to hear you less disembodied.
I think that's a compliment. I appreciate that.
No, it's good.
That's what my wife says when I get home. Nice to hear you less disembodied.
It's a phrase I'll probably never use again.
No, that's okay. I don't mean to embarrass you. Go right on.
I just finished a book called An Indigenous People's History of the United States by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. And that was not for the squeamish. And, you know, as far as land grabs go, you know, you can take this pretty far, you know, because after reading this book and some internet research, there's many people on the indigenous, side of things that think that the United States is a result of the whole U.S. is a result of a land grab, in that we're living on occupied land. And you must have come across some of that in your research. And I wondered if you have an opinion or what you...
Oh, well, that's a fascinating perspective. I haven't read that book, so I can't endorse it directly, but the subject is certainly worth investigating. I thought about that a lot when I read that Supreme Court decision by John Marshall, because you'll recall that what John Marshall said was, everything that's happened up to now, the land the United States has gained through conquest or war or purchase, you know, upstate New York, Manhattan, whatever we're talking about, that's done with. And now we're dealing with the Cherokees, and they have a right to stay. That's a fascinating perspective for Marshall to take. Marshall was a nationalist, so he was okay with the United States being there, but then he argued for the rights of the Cherokees within the United States. You certainly could have done another line of reasoning and say the entire thing was an outrageous injustice. We should think, though, if we want to go that far, because we have a situation where people came from another continent to North America, to what is now the United States. Their governments committed terrible injustices. Many individuals committed terrible injustices. But would you really say that the Europeans had no right to come here at all? Would you say that? Because if you would say that, you would say that no other immigrants had a right later to come to the United States. You would say that no Mexicans have a right to come to the United States. That might be taking the logic too far. The question is how that was going to be done. Was it going to be done within some framework of law and, very importantly, within some framework of justice? And it seems quite obvious all the way along in this story, if we're going to be ruthlessly honest, there were grave injustices. And we even have to be honest, when we look at this period that I study in Jacksonland, there were many people who supported the Indian cause. Many of them were in the North and New England. And it seems to me, looking at it, that one reason they were able to support the Indians, one reason that they were able to be so free in supporting Indian rights, was that they had already obtained most of the land in their particular areas from their local Indians. And so they didn't have the same economic interest that people in the South did in clearing out that land. This is a brutal story. It is an ugly story. But do we want to go so far as to say that nobody here has any right to be here at all, unless you are of Cherokee descent or something? I don't think that anybody would want that. And even John Ross, the principal character here, didn't want that. He didn't say to himself, in the practical situation with which he was confronted, go away, white men. There were other Native leaders who did say that, frankly. There were other contemporaries. We mentioned Osceola. We could talk about Tecumseh. John Ross didn't want out of the United States. He wanted in to the United States. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that makes him a really modern and fascinating character. How did he try to do that? How well did he succeed? And what did the United States do for him and do to him? Because that is what he tried.
Yeah, we'll go back to phone calls in a moment. We haven't gotten to the why John Ross and the Cherokees chose to fight with Andrew Jackson against the Brits. And indeed, that was a part of the story you start the book with, where he is, you know, he's working with Andrew Jackson. He's fighting with Andrew Jackson.
He's a soldier.
Other tribes sided with the Brits. Why?
He's a soldier in Andrew Jackson's army. This is a conscious choice that the Cherokees made, that they wanted to assimilate, that they wanted to grab an opportunity that had been offered by the U.S. government to civilize, to use the word of the time, and adopt white man's ways and advance their society. That's the way that Cherokee leaders saw it. And part of this was fighting alongside the United States. There was a group of troops called the Cherokee Regiment who volunteered for service in the War of 1812. They were called into an army commanded by General Andrew Jackson, and they fought against Creek Red Stick rebels at the Battle of Horseshoe Bend. In fact, they played a crucial role in that victory. And after the war, John Ross wrote that by doing this, they had proven their attachment to the United States and went on to say, listen, okay, give us our rights. We fought for you. Mm-hmm. Some of us have died for you. Give us our rights. He was saying the same thing that African Americans would say after later wars, frankly. It didn't always work out for African Americans. It did work out for John Ross. They won a temporary victory at the time. But from that moment on, it became increasingly clear that his interests and Andrew Jackson's interests were just different. They were both, in their own way, fighting for the same America, the same United States. But within that framework, they were heading on a collision course.
Mm. Aren't you glad you found John Ross so you could do all of this? Because it's so interesting, Steve.
Oh, my goodness. I totally agree. And I did wonder about that, because I wanted there to be a face for the Indian side of this argument.
Right.
And I made a choice. I could have chosen a different leader. This would be a different story if it had been a story about Tecumseh or if it had been a story about Osceola. And so let's confess that. We're never telling the whole story when we pick a couple of guys. But Ross is especially fascinating because he was an English speaker and he was literate, which means that his own words are preserved. There are so many Indian leaders, unfortunately, that we only know about through white observers who may be sympathetic, but they're a filter. And there are great scholars who've gone through that filter and tried to reconstruct what Cherokee life was like or what Creek life was like. And I've learned so much from their work. But I wanted to hear directly from a guy. I wanted to hear directly from a person who was part of this battle. And John Ross left behind hundreds of letters, which makes it possible to bring him to life.
Yeah. And what fun to be in the Library of Congress where there is so much of this material. It's very old and you got to pour through it.
A fantastic institution. And now and again, you end up handling an actual letter written by Andrew Jackson or other items, incredible letters, classified ads from 200-year-old newspapers.
Goodness.
Just amazing documentary material in there.
Thank you so much, Steve, for being with us and for writing the book. It was a great, great pleasure and very informative.
Yay, I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
Stevens Keep, our guest. The book is Jackson Land, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and a Great American Land Grab. Steve, of course, is co-host of NPR's Morning Edition, which is the most widely heard radio news program in the whole country. He's won all kinds of awards, Edward R. Murrow, Robert F. Kennedy Award, Alfred DuPont, Columbia University Award, and is also the author of another book, Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. He's done reporting from all over the world. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.